I'm curious to know who here likes to fish. If you enjoy fishing, just raise your hand. Okay, a fair number of you. Not quite as many as I thought, but a number of you like to fish. Well, for those of you who like to fish, I have to tell you, I am not one of you. For a variety of reasons, I really don't enjoy fishing very much. I'm willing to do it at times, though, because it's an opportunity for me to go and hang out with friends who do like to fish. But what I like much more than fishing is a great fishing story, as long as it's true. Have you noticed that people like to exaggerate when they tell their stories? Sometimes we have to take a fish story with a grain of salt. One of my favorite fish stories of all time is found in the Bible. It's in the book of John in chapter 21. And I love this story because it's true. And I love this story because Jesus is involved. And that means it's about much more than just a great catch. It's a story that has some significant spiritual implications. Now, this story that I'm about to read in a moment takes place maybe 1 to 2 weeks after Jesus has risen from the dead. On this particular day, we're going to see that the disciples of Jesus decide to go fishing. And Jesus, in his own unique way, goes fishing with them. Listen carefully to this story. John chapter 21, starting in verse 1. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them, and they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." And when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It's the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and he jumped into the water. And the other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you've caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come, have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. At the time this story takes place, the disciples know that Jesus has died, and they know that he has returned to life. And they know this because some of them visited the empty tomb. And they know this because Jesus has appeared to them previously. They have seen the resurrected Lord. Now, as we saw last week, the first thing Jesus did on Resurrection Day was appear to his disciples to show up and clarify who he is and what he had accomplished by dying and then overcoming death. It was critical for the disciples to know that Jesus truly was and is the Messiah, the Son of God, the living God. But information alone is not enough. And that's why Jesus always does more than just teach. He spends time with people. Relationship is crucial. So in every resurrection appearance, Jesus takes time to simply be with his followers. He walks with them along a road. He sits down with them at a meal. He shows up on a beach and helps them fish. You see, our knowledge of Jesus always must be combined with our experience of Jesus. Those two things go hand in hand so that we can see Jesus clearly. And by spending time with his followers, Jesus is giving them a chance to experience a completely new understanding of reality. He was dead, and now he's alive. And that takes some getting used to. So he shows up again and again and again. But at the point of this story, he's not yet given his disciples instructions about what to do next. They have no marching orders. And from a practical standpoint, they still need to earn a living. Some of them are fishermen. And so on this particular night, they decide to go fishing so they can take care of themselves and meet their daily needs. Unfortunately, this fishing trip starts out badly. They go out on the Sea of Galilee, and after being out all night, they have nothing, nothing to show for their efforts, as we read in verse 3. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them, and they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. We need to remember that these are experienced professional fishermen. They know how to fish, and they know where to fish, and they are not afraid of hard work. And yet, they fail. They fail because effort alone is never a guarantee of success. I'm sure the disciples understand this. And after being out all night, I know that they're probably frustrated, but they're not complaining that somehow this is unfair. Everyone who goes fishing recognizes that sometimes you succeed and sometimes you don't. Effort does not guarantee the results that we want. And yet, think about how often we act as if we should be rewarded simply because we have expended effort. I recently had a school teacher tell me that a student had submitted a horribly wrong answer to a question on an essay test. And she gave him a zero on that question. And he said, "I invested a lot of effort writing things down. Shouldn't I get some credit?" And she said, "Not when everything you wrote was completely wrong." Now, I find myself sympathizing a bit with that student. It's natural when we have expended energy and effort to want to see some results. But effort alone is not enough. Not in school, not in fishing, and not in many other areas of life. And in this case, Jesus uses the failure of the disciples as a teachable moment. He uses this very normal occurrence of an unsuccessful fishing trip to make a point. Sometimes we cannot succeed without the help of God. And often it's in those moments when our efforts have come to nothing that Jesus shows up. And that's what we see next. Let's look at verse 4. "Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize it was Jesus. He called out to them, 'Friends, haven't you any fish?' 'No,' they answered." So think about this. These disciples are involved in what for them is a familiar, normal, routine task. They're not doing anything spectacular. They're just fishing. Yet that is when Jesus shows up. He often shows up in the midst of normal activities, and those are the moments when we least expect it. I don't know about you, but I tend to compartmentalize my life. And it's easy to fall into this trap that there are times when I expect God to show up. I expect to experience his presence. Moments like this when we're worshiping. Moments during the week when we read the Bible and when we pray. Here's the real question. As we go about our business during the week, are we looking for Jesus? As we run errands, as we pay bills, as we interact with coworkers or talk with our neighbors or watch our kids, as we deal with all the normal and familiar and routine tasks of life, are we ready for God to get our attention? And I know there must be times when God is trying to break into my life and I am just oblivious because I am so consumed by my tasks. Every once in a while, though, I get it right. Like the time I was out mowing my lawn. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw my neighbor come out of his house. I just wanted to finish my chores. But that small, still voice of the Holy Spirit said, "Go talk to your neighbor." So I did. Talked to him for about 10 minutes, and nothing dramatic happened. But I was continuing to build my relationship with a neighbor who was far from God. And as I continued to develop that friendship, who knows what God might do. We need to pay attention to the nudge of God in the midst of our daily stuff when he wants to get our attention. And in the case of the disciples, Jesus does way more than just give them a nudge. He shows up in the flesh and he calls out a greeting. That's hard to miss. And as Jesus gets their attention, we need to remember that his immediate purpose is to drive home the reality of his resurrection. And he wants his followers to have a sense of expectation. He wants them to realize that because he is alive, that extraordinary things can happen. So he does far more than just greet them. He offers them some insights, which produces the dramatic result that's recorded in verses 6 and 7. As we continue on in the story, he, that's Jesus, said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." Now, I find this part of the story really fascinating. These experienced fishermen have been at it all night. They have experienced no success. And then Jesus arrives, and they don't know it's Jesus, and he tells them to fish in a different location. And despite the fact that this man is a stranger, they do what he says. Why would they take the advice of a complete stranger? It turns out that this actually is a fairly typical experience. Fishermen on the Sea of Galilee often operate close to shore. These men are only 100 yards out. And when they do, they often rely on a land-based spotter. Someone standing on the shore is looking at the water from a low angle, and they can see ripples and movement that are not obvious to someone standing on a boat and looking down. And so it's not unusual for fishermen to receive advice like this. Sometimes they'll post a member of their crew on the shore to walk along and be their spotter, and sometimes it's a stranger who just happens to be out on the shore. And so when Jesus calls out and says, here's what I see, here's where you should fish, they respond and they immediately haul in a catch. But not just a normal catch. They are wildly successful. They are so overwhelmed by the number of fish that are in their net that a little later on when they bring that net to shore, they count them. 153 fish. That is an amazing catch. And it's so heavy they can't even lift the net into the boat. And here's what's interesting. It's this series of events which causes them to recognize Jesus. It's a combination of his insight about where to fish, the extraordinary results which demonstrate his ongoing care and concern for the well-being of the disciples. It's this experience that opens their eyes and enables them to realize that this stranger on the shore actually is Jesus. This is a reminder that we know about Jesus through teaching. We know Jesus when we have an encounter with the living Lord. And he still is alive, and he still loves to reveal himself to his people, and he loves to invite his followers to spend time with him because he is alive. We need to do more than just know about Jesus. We need to know Jesus. He's inviting you, inviting me to spend time with him. That's what he does with the disciples. He invites them to bring their catch to the beach and to join him for breakfast, as recorded here in verses 12, 13, and 14. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." And none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. And this was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Jesus is demonstrating here that his priority is relationships. And throughout his ministry, he does lots of teaching, but his teaching consistently is connected to relationship because he loves to spend time with people. It's when he rubs shoulders with people and spends time with them and connects with them. It's through those relationships that he is able to make the love of God more clearly known to them. And so the disciples here respond to his invitation and they sit down to this meal and they have the simple pleasure of enjoying time with Jesus. And they're filled with wonder. They're overwhelmed. Jesus really, truly, still is alive. He's still doing dramatic things. He's still here with us. He's still watching out for us. He's still ensuring that our needs are met. Wow. They spent the night fishing for fish. And Jesus spent the morning fishing for them. He's hooked them and reeled them in. He's captured their minds and their hearts because he wants to equip them with the faith that they will need to live as his followers. And he wants to equip them so that they will be ready when he returns to heaven to do some spiritual fishing in the world around them. This is a great fish story. And it is a true story about Jesus helping his disciples in a way that verifies the reality of his resurrection. That's the immediate purpose of this story. And it's a story that we have in the Bible so that we too can know that Jesus rose from the grave and that he still is watching over his followers. But there's more to this story. You see, we always can learn simply by watching Jesus in action. And there are principles here that Jesus displays that can apply to other areas of life. Principles about our effort, and the need for Jesus to step in and give us his wisdom and his insights. Principles about the importance of not just teaching, but relationships. And we can apply those principles to the way that we go about spiritually fishing. As we try to draw people to God so they can experience firsthand the love of Jesus. And so as we think about this fish story, we learn that the disciples in the Bible were putting forth a lot of effort and not experiencing any results. That's why they needed Jesus to show up and offer some insight so they would start fishing in the right way. And in the same way, I think Jesus is telling us that we need to start spiritually fishing on a different side of the boat. We need to make some changes in the way that we're doing things. And why is that? It's because if we're honest, our current efforts are not producing much results. Many of us don't spend much time with people who are far from God. And that means we're not giving those people an opportunity to have a meaningful, real encounter with the living God through us. And if we want to fulfill the mission that Jesus has given us, then we need to find ways to love God and love others. And we need to love others in some new ways, and we need to love them in some new places. So what might that actually look like in your life and in mine? Well, first, let's consider what it means to go spiritually fishing in some new ways. One insight we gain from Jesus is that information alone is not enough, that relationships are critical. And I don't know about you, but when I encounter a spiritual skeptic, I find myself drawn into what I call the battle of information, and I act as if I just give them enough facts. I can convince them to put their trust in the God who's revealed to us in the Bible. They just need facts to resolve their intellectual doubts. Now, at times that's true, but the fact is that many people in important decisions of life do not act rationally. We human beings are not always rational, and we are not always swayed by facts and information. And here's a case in point. A friend of mine had some neighbors across the street, a large extended family that lived together, and all of these people were heavy, heavy smokers. And in 1 year, they buried 3 of their family members who died from lung cancer. My friend went to the funerals, and at the receptions after each of the funerals, the family all were standing around smoking like crazy. Now, when your family is dropping like flies due to lung cancer, it seems to me that continuing to smoke is not rational behavior. And for my friend, it was like this lightning bolt went off. He said to me, he said, I was trying to reach these people and to share my love of Jesus with them because they were very far from God. And he said, I realized information alone wasn't going to cut it. He said, I want to start fishing off another side of the boat. I'm just going to love them. So he became their friend. He got involved in their lives. He did things with them. He laughed when they laughed. He cried when they cried. He grieved when they grieved. He just walked with them through all of the stuff of life. And over a period of time, several of those neighbors became followers of Jesus. It wasn't information, not initially, that changed them. It was relationship. Someone loving them. Those people had a very real encounter with Jesus Christ, the living God, because they saw and experienced the love of God through my friend. Relationships matter. Here's another example. Several years ago, I told you a story about a very dramatic conversion. This morning, I will just give you the condensed version. It was a story about a man who owned and operated a topless bar. His wife was the star dancer at the bar. and that husband and wife experienced a dramatic transformation and became followers of Jesus Christ because their next-door neighbors, who were believers, loved them. Now, those Christians had to exercise some discernment, like when they were invited to go to the bar to watch her dance, they politely declined. But they didn't shun their neighbors. They invited them over for barbecues. They invited them over to sit and watch sporting events on the TV together. They did life together. And when the woman who was the dancer got sick and was unable to work, they made some dinners and took some meals into the home. And over time, over quite a bit of time actually, that very unspiritual couple started to get curious. They ended up visiting the church, started asking questions, a ton of questions. And they came to a point where they realized, we want a fresh start with Jesus. And so they were baptized and they turned their lives around. Here's what really excites me. The church stepped into their lives and helped each of them find other kinds of employment so that they could earn a living in a way that was honoring God. And about a decade later, here's what really excites me. This couple had been so transformed by Jesus that the man was a deacon in the church, and this former topless dancer had become such an example of godliness that she was overseeing the church women's ministry. Now that's a great spiritual fishing story. A story about lives that are completely transformed because a Christian neighbor said, we will love you and we will walk alongside you through the ups and downs of life. There's an interesting little postscript to this story. As I said, I shared that story during a Sunday morning sermon several years ago. After the service, I walked out in the lobby, and I was confronted verbally by a man who no longer attends this church. And he was angry. He said, you never, never, never encourage Christians to hang out with ungodly people. They will corrupt us. They will stain our reputations. They will soil us and drag us into sin. Wow. And I said, you know, that's not the example of Jesus. The Bible makes it very clear that he did not care about his reputation. He cared that people were spiritually lost. He was fishing for souls. So he hung out with all kinds of people, even some pretty disreputable people. Because that was the way to expose them to God's love. And we are asked to follow his example. And sadly, this man wasn't buying it. He was living what I call the fortress mentality approach to life. And that's a lifestyle where we try to barricade ourselves against the world and we try to insulate and isolate ourselves so that we will have very minimal contact with people who are far from God. And why do Christians sometimes do that? I think we do it usually out of fear. We fear that those kinds of people will make us very uncomfortable. We fear that they will somehow stain us. But we cannot, in this area of life or any area of life, let ourselves be motivated by fear. In the book of 1 John, chapter 4, we read that a person who fears is not living in God's love because God's perfect love can drive out all, not some, but all of our fears. The people of God do not need to be afraid of anyone or anything. And here's the worst thing of all. If we adopt a fortress mentality and live life with that attitude, we're telling the world we won't associate with you until you clean up your act. And I think that breaks the heart of Jesus. He lived in the midst of a very messy world. A world that was much more crude and harsh and vulgar than ours. Yet he spent time with all kinds of people because relationships matter. And it was through relationships that Jesus could demonstrate God's love. And he invites us as his followers to do the same thing. I think there is a significant challenge and a significant invitation for us in this passage that we need to learn to fish in some new ways. And we need to learn to fish in some new places. Now, we can do spiritual fishing anywhere. But this morning, I want to suggest a specific place where you and I can go spiritually fishing. It's in our neighborhoods. In your program this morning, there is a sheet titled My Neighbor Relationships. It looks like this. We have a copy of part of it for you on the screen. And the heart of this sheet is 9 boxes, as you can see here. And these boxes represent the place where you live and your 8 closest neighbors. So if you live in a home, it could be the people on either side of you, the people across the street, the people that back up to you. If you live in an apartment, maybe it's the people along your hall, or maybe down the hall and around the corner. You can figure out who your closest neighbors are. But who are your closest neighbors? And then to challenge us and encourage us to do some spiritual fishing in this place, that sheet has some questions on it. Let's take a look at these questions. Do I know the names of any of my close neighbors? Do I know what any of these neighbors do for a living? Do I know what hobbies they enjoy? Do I know any of their hopes, hurts, or dreams? When was the last time I spoke with them? Have I ever engaged in any kind of social activity with them? And what can I do to be a better neighbor? And what might happen if I start praying for them and for my relationship with them? I was introduced to this sheet by a pastor I know. He called it the sheet of shame. And I have to tell you that for me, that was my experience. You see, I'm sad to say that when I sat down with this sheet and started trying to fill in these boxes to put down some information about my 8 closest neighbors, most of the boxes were empty. A few of them had a first name only. Because I don't know my neighbors very well. And I have a sneaking suspicion that many of you don't either. But I believe that God has placed us in our neighborhoods on purpose, for a purpose. Neighborhoods create natural opportunities for us to connect with others if we're willing to take the time. And it might be that you might live in a more rural situation and you don't have close neighbors. Well, then think about this maybe as neighbors at your place of employment. The guy at the desk next to you, the woman who works in the office next to you, people that you rub shoulders with during the day as you work. You see, one way or another, we all have neighbors. And many of our neighbors are spiritually adrift. And we have the opportunity to touch their lives and draw them to Jesus. We've summarized all this in a very simple way in the Garden Way Church mission statement. We want to know him, to love him, and to share him. That very simple biblical statement summarizes our purpose as a community of faith, and we don't want to forget it, which is why we printed it out in the lobby above the gym doors. And I want to encourage you, every time you walk through our lobby, take a moment and read that mission statement. And say, Lord, today and throughout this week, how can I embrace that mission? How can I live it out? And we embrace that purpose when we take time to be with Jesus through things like prayer and Bible reading so we can know him better and experience more of his love. And we embrace this purpose when we look for opportunities to share Christ's love in practical ways with the people that he places around us. We're being invited to be the hands and feet of Jesus to our neighbors. Let's be willing to invest the time to get to know them. Let's get involved in their lives. And let's not approach them as a project. Let's go with one agenda only, to be a friend looking for opportunities to demonstrate the love of God. And then let's pray that over time, some of our neighbors, yours and mine, will have a life-changing encounter with Jesus, the living God, because you and I took the time to simply love them. So, I'm going to keep this sheet on my desk at home. I'm going to use these questions on this sheet as an incentive to motivate me to get to know my neighbors better and to be more intentional about building relationships with them. And as I learn things about my neighbors, I'm going to write that information down on this sheet so that during my times of prayer, I can pray for them more effectively and more intelligently. And along the way, I want to be open and available for Jesus to interrupt me and say, "Here's something you can do to demonstrate my love to this neighbor." I've been so challenged and convicted this week as I pondered over this passage and pondered its implications. And I am committed to following the advice of Jesus. I'm going to start fishing off the other side of the boat in my neighborhood. Will you join me? Will you join me and trying to reach the people God has placed around you? If we take this seriously, we can make a difference in our world.